Please the court, Your Honors. My name is Rick Matthews. Seated at the council table with me is my associate, Kristen Yergovich. We're here today representing the appellants, Hampton Roads, and its named trustees, and are asking the court to reverse the trial court's decision imposing a constructed trust on certain property, which the bank held as collateral, and enter a final judgment in this case in favor of the bank and trustees. This case, upon review, is not unlike that previously decided by this court in Crestar v. Williams at 250 Virginia, 198. In that case, the trial court likewise imposed a constructed trust trumping valid liens of Crestar Bank, which was a judgment creditor. Under the facts of Crestar v. Williams, you have basically a swindler that accepted money being invested by land investors, went out, bought property as sort of a Ponzi scheme, took off and disappeared. Several creditors, including Crestar Bank, took a judgment for defaulted loans and transactions against Mr. Williams. Three of the investors filed suit asking for two things. One, a money judgment against Mr. Williams, and two, the imposition of a constructive trust upon the property remaining in Williams' name. The trial court, in affirming a finding by a commissioner in chancery, held that the people who were swindled got their money judgment, but they also got a lien in the property that Williams still owned, superior to that of Crestar Bank, which was a prior docketed judgment creditor. The case came to this court, and Justice Compton held that no, this was a misapplication of the application of a constructive trust. Why? Because there was no evidence that these properties that were still held in Williams' names were specific properties that these people who were swindled had lent money for. And as a consequence, you were dealing with a different or unknown corpus at the time that they lent their money and got swindled. And therefore, constructive trust did not apply. The application of the constructive trust was dismissed, but the money judgment that was awarded those creditors remained to stay put. Now, why do I mention Crestar? And I really focused on this in going back and reviewing for this case, because Crestar really says that the same rules of a constructive trust that the trial court applied here are invalid. Now, what do we have here?
Well, Crestar, to summarize it in one sentence, in Crestar we said, in order to be entitled to the benefit of a constructive trust, a claimant's interest must be distinctly traced into the chosen action, fund, or other property which is to be made the subject of the trust. In this case, we had lot one, which was the subject, well, actually the first thing we had was her choice of lots. That choice was made, it was lot one, it was sold to somebody else. She didn't put her deed to record or ask for one to be put to record.
That's correct.
Which may be significant for something else. But when all is said and done, you have somebody who is a BFP who purchased lot one. And now what was sought was a constructive trust on lot A. It's a completely different lot.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And what you're saying is that that's on all fours with Crestar. I may very well agree with you, by the way. At that point in time, isn't this case over? The BFP analysis doesn't seem to apply in any way, shape, or form if you prevail on that.
Oh, I think it should have been over. You got to look at how the bank got brought into this. The bank got brought into this case after the BFP's folks had paid her $25,000 to release any claim to lot one, and in a second amended complaint, all of a sudden the Bank of Hampton Roads, my client, and the trustees are joined in as a defendant, and basically plaintiff says, oh, well, we didn't get lot one, which is what we amended the contract and bargained for, and because we didn't get lot one, in addition to leaving this case out there for claim of damages for business torts and breach of contract against the folks who breached their contract with the developer. Well, we think she ought to get some other piece of property that the bank had collateralized.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Bank of Hampton Roads got into this case in February 2004. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it got into it by making a loan, a development loan, to the developer.
It wasn't a development loan. It was an acquisition loan.
Okay, I'm sorry. An acquisition loan to the developer.
The loan to purchase aggregated raw property, several parcels,
okay. That
the developer, 3 Mac 2, was going to consolidate and then subdivide.
So at the time the bank got into it, by making the acquisition loan, Mrs. Powell had identified the property she wanted.
No, sir. She had not. In 2004, her contract with 3 Mac 2 said that she gets, at closing, she gets $265,000 cash and a lot to be named later.
Yep.
You see, the property had not been subdivided. There were no lots in existence at that point in time.
And that's where I'm heading. She identified lot one as it was shown on the preliminary subdivision plan, correct?
In 2005.
Okay.
After the loan had closed.
Okay, so the bank has its interest. The bank know in the entire property. The bank knows that she has an interest. And she identifies the property that she wants. Lot number one as shown on the preliminary subdivision plan. There was no lot one at that time, though. There was only the future expectation of a lot one.
That is
which
correct.
Would occur when the subdivision plat was recorded, which didn't occur until years and years later.
Yes, sir.
So at that point, she still had an interest in the only property that there was, which was an unsubdivided parcel. Correct?
No, sir. I don't think I'm following.
In 2005, there was no lot. There was only the amorphous parcel that would eventually become lot.
No, sir, that's not correct. In 2004, when she entered into her contract and the bank made the acquisition loan to 3 Mac 2, it was a lot to be determined later. That closed. Then thereafter, the Bank of Hampton Roads had to get out. It had reached its lending limits, and it could not do the development loan.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in time, in 2005, the development loan was issued by Gateway Bank, which was a different bank.
And Hampton Roads got back in 2007.
That is correct. But Bank of Hampton Roads was not in when she selected the lot. Nor was it ever given notice that she had selected lot one, nor was Gateway ever given notice she selected lot one, nor did she ever record the contract.
When did the subdivision plat go of record?
Subdivision plat went to record after 2005.
After 2007.
It was years later. 2007. When the preliminary subdivision plat, I know, had been done, and she'd selected lot one later in 2007. I don't know the date of that subdivision.
Preliminary subdivision plan, it never goes of record. Correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
A preliminary subdivision plan is never recorded.
No, there has to be a final subdivision plan. And I don't know when that was. I don't know when that was planned, Your Honor. I don't know. It had to be, it was at some point thereafter.
Until a lot is created, her interest is in the whole. When she first identified and said, I would like lot one whenever it's created, her interest was in the entire parcel because there was no lot.
It was
an amorphous whole.
But the preliminary subdivision plat, which ultimately became the subdivision plat. Otherwise, lot number one could not have been sold to a BFP in 2012. And the reason it was a BFP in 2012 is because she never notified anybody that she had amended her contract to a specific designated piece of property as shown on the plat. She never did. And so that's ultimately becomes parcel one. So then she files suit, rightfully so, against 3MAC2 and its individual principals for money damages, and she asked in her initial complaint for the imposition of a constructive trust against lot one. Bank of Hannah Rose is nowhere near that case. She then settles her case and releases lot one and receives $25,000. And, of course, the case remains for breach of contract and business torts against 3MAC2 and its principals. And then in the second amended complaint, comes back and says, oh, by the way, in addition to this claim for money damages, I want you to impose a constructive trust on parcel A.
Essentially, what she was saying is that she has a right to lot 1, lot A, lot B, lot C, lot 20, until she gets enough money to compensate her for her ultimate loss.
That's basically what she's saying, and that's not the law of constructive trust. She has a money damages claim. She has a judgment, or the way the trial court did it, there's not a judgment in her. What I'm urging this court to do is reverse and remand, order final judgment entered for the bank and the trustees, and a money judgment implemented as for the finding on the prior bifurcated part of this case against 3MAC2 and its principals. She's got a remedy.
May I interrupt you one more time? The trial judge made a factual finding that the bank official during the evidentiary hearing, quote, testified that he knew of the plaintiff's claim on lot one.
That is incorrect. That is incorrect.
Correctly said that, but it's incorrect that it's true.
No, it's incorrect that it was said.
Please
read the transcript.
Well, we're talking past each other. I'm agreeing with you. The trial judge correctly, this is a correct statement of the trial judge's finding that lot one was within the actual knowledge of the bank, but when you go back to the transcript, that's not at all what he says.
That is correct.
So we've gone from knowledge that maybe some lot somewhere in this ultimate subdivision to lot one, which they don't know about, to lot A, which they never knew about.
That is correct.
And that's what's on appeal.
That is correct.
That is
an erroneous ruling of the trial court. I've got about 2 minutes and 20 seconds left. I'd like to hold the rest for rebuttal.
Well, I'm going to take up some of that, counsel. I want to go back to a general concept we were talking about, but I'm going to try to approach it from a different perspective because I think you and I talked past each other as well.
May very well be, huh?
Okay. In 2004, Ms. Powell, had an interest in an unsubdivided parcel. Is that correct?
To be named later.
She had an interest in the whole. Is that correct?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. You read the contract. It's not an interest in the whole. It says a lot to be determined later, and you're talking about multiple owner, large acreage parcel of property.
When she sold the property, which was one parcel, she maintained an interest in that one unsubdivided, unplatted, undeveloped parcel, did she not?
She had an inchoate property interest, yes.
Okay, great. Now, your position is that at some point, her interest in the whole became an interest in a very specific part.
That is correct.
What caused that?
The amendment to the contract that attached the preliminary subdivision plat that said, this is lot one. It ultimately became lot one as shown on that plat. You look in the record, you see the amendment.
On what date did her interest go from an interest in the whole to an interest in only a part?
Early part of 2005.
By what action did it
become? By amendment to the contract.
Okay.
Between her and 3MAC.
Okay. Despite the fact that at that moment there was not that part did not yet exist.
It existed as between those parties. It was not formally of record recorded in a plat.
Do you agree with me that it only becomes a lot when it goes of record?
And
this is black letter law.
Yes, Your Honor, and it ultimately did. That doesn't give her an
interest. Was she notified when it went of record? Does the record?
Your Honor, I have no idea. That was between her and 3MAC, and that's the point I'm getting at. Her cause of action here is for breach of contract and or business torts against 3MAC. It is not for an imposition of constructive trust that, in effect, makes a super lien of hers paramount to the bank's deed of trust that went into effect in 2007, 2 years after the contract had been amended between her and 3MAC.
But before the lot was created.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know when the subdivision plat went to record. I simply wasn't involved. I don't know. And there's nothing in the record to show. But it showed that it ultimately went to record, and it had to ultimately go to record for it to have been sold in 2012 to Ashton Builders by 3MAC out from under Ms. Powell. There's no question they sold it out from under Ms. Powell. But that doesn't affect the Bank of Hampton Roads.
The Bank of Hampton Roads knew of her interest when it got involved.
It knew of its interest
and
back,
her interest
back in
2004,
Your Honor. Your Honor, but back in 2004, the development loan was done at Gateway. She never notified Gateway. There was nothing in those files that came over. In 2007, the bank went through, if you check the record, the bank went through the entire loan process again. This was treated as a new development loan by the Bank of Hampton Roads. As part of that development loan, there was a title search that showed no reservation of her in any lot. Okay? It also, as part of the loan papers, you will see in there, that there was an affidavit signed by the borrowers that there were no liens or claims against any of the property of which they were aware. Now, that's 2007. So, basically, you would have to say, okay, bank, you need to go back and check your acquisition loan from 2004 and go back and look at all those contracts and go back and see that a woman that you have no privity with or relationship to at all and go ask her, oh, Ms. Powell, excuse me, did our borrowers lie to us when they gave us this affidavit and said there were no liens against the property? And oh, by the way, did you forget to record this so that we would have record notice that you had a claim against
three
a specific
lot? 3 years earlier, the bank loan officer knew that she had a claim on a lot. And in 2007, there's no indication that the lot had yet been created.
And so we're going
so
to...
Is the bank not charged in 2007? With the
Absolutely
excuse
not.
Me, excuse me, counsel. I haven't answered.
I'm
I
sorry?
Haven't asked my question yet. Is the bank not charged in 2007 with the same knowledge it had in 2004?
No, sir, it's not. You have a three-year period. If you're going to impose this obligation on a bank, you might as well not have... Heck, all the banks that are in Virginia would leave and you'd never get another one to come. You can't impose that. When a loan is treated as a new loan and title is examined, and it's clear, and
I'm
you
not
have...
I'm asking about the examination of title. I'm asking...
That's absolutely...
Excuse me, counsel, may I please finish? I'm asking about the examination of the bank's own loan file. This is not a different bank we're talking about. This is the same bank, the same loan
Your
officer,
it is
perhaps?
A different loan. It is a different loan.
So you're saying
how
a
many
bank,
transactions
a bank
go through a bank? Yes, Your Honor, you and I have a fundamental difference, I think,
indeed,
on what a
do,
bank
and
should
my
be required to do.
All right.
I really want to save time for rebuttal, but we've gone a little bit over.
Well, you're well into it. Your time has expired.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Honorable Justices. My name is Greg Larson, and I represent Ethel Powell. As far as the factual matter, it was not put to record until 2008. And the distinction and the difference in this case is that the lending officer, Greg Marshall, had actual knowledge of her contingency right. He recognized it as a cloud on the title. He had his own assistant, the one of only two people that ran, ordered the title, Renee. Renee brought the title binder back. It was not noted, this contingency, and they did not make any notations either to correct the title record or either to note it in their own loan file. They also knew, Mr. Marshall testified, that he was simply parking the loan over with the other bank who he was friends with and had done before, knowing he was going to get it back for the developmental loan side of this.
May I interrupt you and ask you this question? The trial judge stated in her letter opinion, quote, that the bank official testified he knew the plaintiff's claim on lot one. And then the trial judge held the bank's wrongdoing led to the sale of lot one to Ashton Builders. Am I wrong that the trial judge premised her whole reasoning on a factual mistake?
In my view, no. You are correct that that was her statement, and you are also likewise correct that Mr. Marshall never acknowledged that he had knowledge of her lien on or her right to lot one.
But doesn't that mean the best case scenario for you under your best argument? Doesn't that mean under your best argument you could get no further than a remand? Because we couldn't, I don't think, affirm on a completely different theory where fact finding is relevant and fact finding has been conceivably rendered unreliable.
Well, I kind of said yes or no, and I didn't get a chance to finish the other part. The importance of her finding, and what I think her finding was, is that the bank had actual knowledge of her right to a lot. The fact that it was lot one, she only says, and she is correct factually, had the bank caused the title to be so flagged or marked, it would not have been released to the Ashton Builder. So she's absolutely correct. The only incorrect part, there was three elements of that statement. In my view, my humble view, the only incorrect part of the trial judge, of her stating that the Bank of Hampton Roads had actual knowledge of her right to lot one. I think ultimately the fact, however, is that since they had knowledge of her actual right to a lot, I think that part of it, the lot one, was not critical and had nothing to do with her ultimate decision. The fact of what was relevant to the trial judge was that the bank had actual knowledge. Not only did the bank have actual knowledge, justices, but they also, and the court found, had constructive knowledge. Because you had the expert, we called Ms. McDuffie, who testified that this was not prudent banking practices. In fact, I would suggest this was part of the loose lending practices of the time, and that had they followed reasonably imprudent banking practices, it would have been flagged.
This is my last question on the subject, I promise you. The holding of the trial judge, when you get past the fact statements that you and I are just talking about, the holding was the defendant's wrongdoing, which the trial judge says the sale of lot one is the wrongdoing, robbed the plaintiff of possession of the original lot specified in her contract. Well, the original lot specified in her contract was lot one. The point I'm trying to make to you to help you educate me on your argument is it seems like the entire premise of this case, but from the trial court's perspective, is founded upon a house of cards factually, because none of those facts are true. They did not know about lot one. They did not, through wrongdoing, rob her of lot one. The wrongdoing was the developer. And the constructive trust was not put on lot one. It was put on a completely different lot. How could we affirm that?
Well, Judge, Justice, remember there are 45 lots in this third subdivision. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, the testimony had been at the trial against the developers is that all lots were the same. They were all same price for every single lot. They had already made $4 million on the first two phases. With all due respect, the only minor error, and I would submit it's a very minor error of the trial court's statement, is as to lot one. But I disagree. The whole premise of the court's finding and of our argument is the original contract called for her to receive a lot in the subdivision. The subdivision was ultimately not even put to record until 2008. The bank gave the financing, the original acquisition finding, and the Bank of Hampton Roads, through Greg Marshall, testified. Not only did he review the contract and have actual knowledge, He also went out to the physical site to see the lot and was further told by the developers that, yes, they had to give her a right. This particular lot, Ms. Powell's property, was critical to them being able to make a third phase. Without her lot, they didn't have the entry or exit, I can't remember which, to actually make the subdivision. So, again, the whole, at some point later, when there was a preliminary site plan, which was not put to record at the time, she did select one, and that was just a written agreement, a lot selection agreement. By the time that lot, or by the time she became aware that it was sold, there were only two lots left in the subdivision, Lot 1 and Lot A. The trial court found, and the evidence demonstrated, that they did have actual knowledge of this contingency, and the trial court found, as was suggested, they didn't lose this. It just because of the lapse of time did not constitute a situation where they just lost this factual knowledge. They knew exactly what they were doing. Sending it over, we're going to get it right back. They have the title binder, and they don't mark it. They don't flag it. They don't flag it in their own records, and it's very clear why they didn't. Mr. Marshall testified it was insignificant at the time because in Phase 1 and Phase 2, we had gotten the note proceeds from every sale. The lots were $50,000 loan, but they realized $80,000 a lot, so there was plenty of value, and therefore he felt it was unnecessary to have to flag it and bring it to the bank's attention or to flag it in the records, which would have then prevented or put Ashton Builders, the buyer of Lot 1, on notice of this claim.
Can I ask you this question?
Yes.
I understand the argument for constructive trust on Lot 1, but once she settles on that specific piece of property which she had selected and accepts money damages, why doesn't that forfeit a claim for completely different constructive trust on a different piece of property?
Well, again, for me, I would answer it as looking at the history of what this court has said about a constructive trust and the different applications that the court has used it. This is something that is a vehicle the courts have used to prevent an injustice. And there has been a myriad of different applications of constructive trust. The requirement in this case is that the property, the interest is identifiable. Her contract, her main contract, was for a lot. It didn't start off it was this lot. It was a lot in the subdivision. The testimony was that all lots...
Right, but the wrong was selling the lot she had selected out from under her.
The wrong by the developers had been, that's correct. But, again, there still was an injustice, and at this point, there was only one lot left. The testimony had been that the lot was of the similar value. They were all marked. All 45 were sold for the exact same thing. And so the court concluded, and I think consistent with precedent, that a constructive trust was the only vehicle to remedy this injustice.
Counsel, if she if a wrong had been committed against her and she had gone to court prior to 2008 and had obtained a judgment against Bank of Hampton Roads, her judgment would have attached to the entire larger parcel because there was no lot.
That is correct. If it had been prior to 8, it would have been the entire parcel. That's exactly correct. That was her interest.
So you're not entitled to make up the facts of the case.
I'm sorry?
You're not entitled to make up the facts of the case. We have a case that's based on the record. And in the trial judge's opinion, this case is about Lot 1. And this case is about a constructive trust on Lot A. And that's the factual posture of this case. And all the woulda, coulda, shouldas are not going to change that. So the question that Justice McCullough was asking is, what is the authority in a case where Lot 1 was identified as the reason for the trial judge's decision, imposing a constructive trust on Lot A, an entirely different piece of property? That's your case, not all the ifs and coulds.
I agree.
All right, so where's the authority for putting a constructive... This order and this opinion says Lot 1 is the issue. You sold it out from under her. She probably should have recorded the deed. She didn't. I'm not going to deal with that. But nonetheless, you sold it out from under her. So what I'm going to do is now there's a lot A out there. There's only two left, right? Well, it seems to me irrelevant there's only two left. What you have is lot one is the subject of the malfeasance, if you will. Lot A has nothing to do with the malfeasance. What's your authority for a constructive trust?
Well, Judge, I would like to just start with the breach was the failure to convey a lot. And I agree with you that there's nothing relevant about the fact that there was only two lots. I concede that. But what I do believe is irrelevant is that the lots were, in essence, the same. Her contract was to get a lot. There were only...
No lots were the same. None of them are the same. You look out this window, you see a tree. You look out this window, you see a lake. I mean, no lot. We've talked about the non-fungible nature of real property. That one doesn't fly. The question is, how do you get a constructive trust on lot A when the trial judge said that the problem is lot one?
Justice, I would concede that the legal basis to have a right to correct the injustice would be if there is, that it is relatively similar. I agree, nothing is exactly the same, but as far as this purpose is, the value is the issue. The uniqueness of this contract is the value of the land.
She got a judgment for $110,000. This is one of the most unusual orders I've ever seen. Plaintiff cannot have both a constructive trust, as defined in herein, and in addition, the monetary judgment for $110,000. If plaintiff doesn't receive the subject property pursuant to the constructive trust, then plaintiff shall have judgment, the money judgment, against 3MAC. It seems to me that she's demonstrated clearly she has an adequate remedy at law. She's got it, number one, which may be fatal to the imposition of the constructive trust in the first place. But the idea that somehow lot A is where you put a constructive trust, why not put it on a separate subdivision that has the same size lots? Why not go across town where this builder is building houses with the same general plans for the houses, the same size plot? Why not do that?
Well, Justice, you're now asking me questions that are outside this record as well. I mean,
That's my point. The whole case is based outside of the record. The record in this case is lot one is in contest, and the fix is lot A gets a constructive trust. I just don't know how you get there.
And, Your Honor, I would submit that the case is not about the failure to convey lot one. The breach was the failure to convey a lot in this subdivision. That was the breach.
Wasn't there an amendment to the contract where she selected lot one? So if we roll back in time, maybe you'd have a stronger argument. But once she makes that selection, that's the breach, is she picked that lot and they sold it out from under her.
I agree that is the breach. There was a lot selection that did where she did choose lot one. However, again, from the equitable principles in this situation, it's not about whether the lot, or this one looks prettier, or this one is got a V shape and this one's got a rectangular shape, this one's a square shape. The point is the value is the same. It is the only way she is able to recover the value of her contract.
Okay, but if land is fungible in that way, then why isn't financial compensation, what is wrong with a financial compensation remedy as opposed to a constructive trust?
Well,
I mean, how is she left short is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, two ways. First of all, if I may, and I want to answer that question, that it certainly begs the question of whether or not, which I don't think is the law, there has to be an absence of another remedy. That I think that's more in terms of other equitable principles, but not in a constructive trust. Constructive trust is a function of tracing. In this case, the way it ultimately came down is that you have a $110,000 judgment, which was stipulated to. And remember, part of the reason I would submit, in fairness to the trial judge, that the order is a little weird is because the trial, we ended up quadricating, not bifurcating, but quadricating, and took one thing at a time, and in hindsight, I don't think that was a very good thing to do. But that's what happened. I mean, and there was... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. To answer
the direct question, Your Honor, is the property, for example, in real case, in these cases, the facts is the property's value has increased now. So just having the money judgment for 110 is not going to give her the remedy. And I would suggest that that's the whole point of why the tracing of the property was necessary. I'm sorry, Justice. Did I miss a question?
No. I want to make sure you didn't stop.
I'm just
answering
sorry.
His question.
I'm over time, and I request that if there's any other question to answer.
All right. It doesn't seem that there are any. Call the next case.